All right, so by way of review, last week we saw 9 years Joseph was second in command of Egypt. 9 years. And he did not contact his family, but out of nowhere, his brothers show up. They're in line to get grain just like everyone else. And you can imagine, like I said last week, the emotions that would have flooded into his head at that point. It's just crazy. You haven't seen them in how many years? Can anyone remember? Joseph had not seen his brothers for how many years?
27.
22.
Correct, 22. That is right, 22 years. A lot can happen in 22 years. All right, so the main question that's in his mind and the main question that's going to be for four whole chapters is, have they changed as brothers? Have they really changed? Have they learned from their mistake and their sin or not? So that's the main question that's on his mind. And the only way to really accurately find out if they have learned and changed is to test them. And I don't know what your debrief groups got into last week, but in Karn and I's, we actually had really good questions to start with. Awesome. And then we got into a couple of the debrief questions. And the second one was, is this normal? Is it normal for people to test other people to see if they're properly having strong allegiance to God or not? Is that normal that we see in Scripture? And the answer is yes, that we do see it in Scripture. We see it in 1 John chapter 4 and Matthew 7. They both talk about false teachers. How in the world can you tell whether someone is speaking the truth or being a false teacher? 1 John 4 says, you test them. You try the spirits. And Matthew 7 says, by their fruits ye shall know them. Not by what they say, look at their actions. You know the phrase, actions speak louder than words. So you do see it in Scripture. You see it when Christ often gave these parables that were focused towards the Pharisees to test them. And they often got the point that it was convicting to them. You also see in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12, that God tests us all the time. And again, there is a difference between testing someone and tempting someone. Tempting is so you fail. That's the motive. For a test, the motive is that you succeed, you pass, and you grow from it. But in 1 Peter 4:12, it says, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, get this, which is to try you. The fiery trial, which is to try you. All right? So Joseph tests his brothers. What was the first test? Can anyone remember?
To see if Benjamin was alive.
Correct. Is Benjamin alive? So bringing Benjamin down back to Egypt from Canaan would prove to them that they were honest about what they said, which would be showing that they're more honest than they were in the past. And there is this danger that they might have killed Benjamin. It's more likely that they would have killed Benjamin than they would the patriarch of the whole family killing Jacob. But 22 years have happened. Like I said, they may have gotten rid of Benjamin. So he wants to see if Benjamin's alive. Test two, can they pick one person to go? So he says, okay, here's the group of brothers. Send one to get Benjamin. Do they pass this test? No, they fail. They can't decide. No one's the leader and says, okay, you're going or I'm going. They all can't decide. So then Joseph changes the rules. And then he says, okay, the group can go, but one must stay. One must stay behind in prison. So you can bring that son, the son Benjamin, back. And do they pass this test? It appears so in Scripture because in verse 20 it says, and they did so. So they do pick someone. They pick Simeon. So Simeon stays. Yeah, so the guards tie up Simeon right in front of them, just like the Ishmaelites would have tied up Joseph right as they led him away down to Egypt. So they tie him up. It's, again, reminding them what they did to their brother. So Simeon is tied up. You can imagine if you were putting yourself in his shoes, maybe that little voice back in your head saying, are they really going to come back for me? We didn't go and save Joseph. Are they really going to travel back all the way to save me? I don't know. It's a tense situation. But Joseph's not done making it more complicated. Turn to Genesis 42. Genesis chapter 42. We'll pick up where we left off. Verse 25. Genesis chapter 42, verse 25. It says, "Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and to restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way, and thus he did unto them. And they laded their," we'll go with donkeys, "and they laded their donkeys with corn and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey provender in the inn," remember this is like a 500-mile journey, all right? They're going to take some pit stops. So one brother comes out, takes his sack full of grain to feed his animal, and he espied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, "My money is restored, and lo, look, it's even in my sack. It's right here." You know, for the normal person, for them to find like a $100 bill like blowing in the wind, that like makes their month, okay? They may do a little dance. It's like, yes, come on, I am going shopping tonight. We have that type of reaction when we find free money. But for them, these brothers, this is the last thing that they would want to find, because it doesn't look good. It looks like they stole it. It's their money in their little pouch, and it's like, I should not have this. And they're thinking, oh, obviously there's some guy back in Egypt, some astute Egyptian accountant going over his clay tablet. You know, it wasn't an Apple tablet, but it was a clay tablet. And he's like, wait a second. This brother didn't pay. Guards. So then that brother, who's looking at the sack and he's looking at his money, maybe even looked around, looking back towards Egypt. Is there anyone coming towards? It's just, it's intense. Okay, so on top of the fact that they have to go and see their father and try to think of what to say to their father, because they're basically like, okay, things didn't go too well, but we need to bring back Benjamin. Trying to word that in a nice way. And on top of that, now if they do go back to Egypt, they're under this pretense of being thieves. So it does not look good. So you can understand how they react. But just one more point before that. The purpose of this, why did Joseph put the money in the sacks? Well, it really heightens the test, doesn't it? It's giving an opportunity for them to show integrity, but it's also that much harder to return. Will they be loyal to Simeon? Or is this too risky now to go back? Are they going to take the money and run? They can last a little bit longer at the grain. Maybe they can find some other way of not going to Egypt. So the test is that much greater. Now look how they react. And their heart failed them. This literally means, the word means to exit out, to come out. So I think of when you get that lump in your throat, and it's like you want to cough out your spleen, and you're like, you're anxious, and it's hard for you to breathe. That's what they're feeling at this moment. They're stressed out. And it says, and they were afraid. If you want to be super literal on this word, they were shaking. They were trembling in fear to see this money. Saying one to another, what is this that God has done unto us? So, okay, they're terrified. But at least, you know, at least they're putting God into the picture, right? Because they haven't seemed to care about God throughout their whole lives, and now it's like they're actually bringing him up into conversation. What has God done unto us? And it's like, okay, well, you did the sin. You're now just dealing with the consequences of your sin. So it's not God's fault, although they're kind of talking that way. But it's like, hey, great, at least you're thinking about God. So it's like, yes, Reuben, okay? Now you thought that this wouldn't, that you thought, okay, I'll just save Joseph. It's not so bad if we throw him in the pit, all this stuff. And okay, Levi, you're looking at this like maybe God didn't care that I could do this and I could get away with it. But you know what? God is out there. And God did see what happened. It reminds me of the verse in 2 Chronicles 16:9, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him." So God is watching. Now the narrator, he kind of hits the fast forward. It takes weeks to go back home, but it's like, zzz, and now they're home, and now they get to see Jacob. So now this is crunch time. They're thinking, we got to get Benjamin and head back to Egypt to save Simeon. So look at verse 29. "And they came unto Jacob their father, unto the land of Canaan, and told him all that befell unto them, saying, The man who is the lord of the land spake roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. And we said unto him, we are true men, we are not spies. And we be 12 brethren, sons of our father. One is not, it's Joseph, one is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the lord of the country, said unto us, hereby shall I know that ye are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me. That's a nice way of putting it. Where's Simeon? In prison. And they're saying like, oh, just leave him here with me. He can stay in my palace. It'll be fine. And take food for the famine of your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother unto me. Then shall I know that ye are no spies and that ye are true men. So I will deliver you, your brother, and ye shall traffic in the land. Meaning you'll be able to trade now. Now that we're good. Now that you kept your promise. So you remember how Jacob was at the start of this chapter? How is Jacob feeling? Head of the family. What's going on? Nick?
He didn't want to die of starvation.
Yeah. And why was he frustrated?
Because the brothers weren't doing anything?
Yeah, they weren't. They were just sitting around doing nothing. And their families are starving to death. And their grain supplies are going lower and lower and lower and lower. And Jacob's like, what are you doing? I've heard a report that down in Egypt is grain. Go, and he says, go that we may live and not die. Guys, it's been a month since that situation. Okay, so those, each of their families, Reuben's family, Levi's family, Simeon's family, they're all starving to death, slowly. So you can imagine at this point that as one brother is explaining the whole story to their father, you know, they all come up to Jacob, and one just starts laying it, this is what happened for, it's been like a month. This is all what happened. You can imagine all the other brothers are now getting out their bags of grain, and you can imagine that all their families have seen, oh, they're here, and they're gathering a crowd, and they're starting to hand out grain so their families can have food. That's how we should picture this scene. Now look at the next verse. And it came to pass as they emptied their sacks that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. Okay, not just one person. Every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw that the bundles of money, they were afraid. They were terrified. They're all shocked. They kind of softened the story. But now that everyone is like, whoa, whoa, why is your money in the sack? You know, what is Jacob going to think? His sons that he hasn't really trusted in the past, and now all their money is returned unto them with all this extra grain. It just doesn't look good. Now, what is Jacob going to say? Because Jacob hasn't spoken yet. The narrator hasn't given us Jacob's perspective. And this is so revealing what he says. So look what Jacob says in verse 36. And Jacob their father said unto them, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. Look at what you've done to me. It's like Groundhog Day. You know, they come back, and yet again, they are a brother short. And whose fault is it? You know, Jacob doesn't give them an inch of leeway. It's their fault. It's ironic because it's like Jacob could care less what this guy in Egypt says. He sees his sons, and he says, you're the ones that have bereaved me from my children. And it's interesting because he lumps Joseph in there too. And it's like, we know that Jacob doesn't know about what the brothers did with Joseph. But there is kind of that sense of negligence that it's like they could have prevented something bad from happening to Joseph. And now they could have prevented something bad from happening to Simeon, but due to their fault, they could not save this other son. For what it's worth, Reuben tries to be the hero. Look at verse 37. Reuben said, and spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee, deliver him into my hands, I will bring him to thee again. I promise on the life of my two sons, I can do it. I can save him. Look what Jacob says. And he said, my son, he's referring to Benjamin, shall not go down with you. No. Now remember, Reuben did something that caused him to lose his birthright long before we started the story in 37. So there's this idea of not trusting the oldest brother. So Jacob does not trust Reuben. My son Benjamin shall not go down with you, for his brother, meaning Joseph, is dead, and he is left alone. That last part must have stung. Do you know what he's implying there? For his brother, Joseph is dead, and he is left alone. The he there is not Simeon, being alone in prison in Egypt. Who is the he? Benjamin. And why is that so significant? He's left alone. Is he alone? Nick?
Because Rachel, he was like the only son that was left of Rachel, and yeah. Jacob loved Rachel instead of David.
That's exactly right. So despite the fact that, not counting Simeon, Benjamin has 9 other brothers in this scene, yet in Jacob's mind, he's the only one of Rachel. So he's all alone. It's like, ouch. Again, the other brothers are expendable. But all he cares about is Benjamin. And it's hard because, you know, the brothers aren't innocent, all right? They've made plenty of mistakes. They're wicked men. But yet again, we're seeing this favoritism by Jacob. It's this the same root problem that caused all of this, that this cascading effect from 37. I really don't believe things would have gone this way if there was no favoritism in their family, even with the dreams that made Joseph seem so special. But it's because they favored, especially Jacob, because they favored Joseph. They made him the coat of many colors. They gave him the special treatment. That's what caused this rift. So these two groups, there's Joseph and Benjamin and the rest of the brothers. It's really sad to see. If mischief befall him by the way in which he shall go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. You'll kill me if I lose him. You're fine. You can go and travel and whatever. But if Benjamin dies, I die. Really sad because he's willing to cut his losses in like the worst possible way. He's willing to let Simeon die in Egypt and let the tribe die as a whole because their grain supplies are just going to get lower and lower as the days go on. All because he wants to save Benjamin from leaving. Isn't that incredible? It's like, ugh. Still that favoritism causing huge issues. It reminds me of a scene in Lord of the Rings on Return of the King. For those of you that know the movie, I'll provide a little context if you don't. Towards the end of the movie, I say end of the movie because the movie's like forever long. In the extended edition, it's over 4 hours long. It's crazy. Like you like leave to the bathroom and you get food. And you take a nap. And you come back and watch the rest of the movie. It's just forever long. But anyways, towards the end of the movie, you have this guy called... I'll get his name right. His cool name. Denethor. Denethor. That's this steward of Gondor. He's this guy in charge of this huge, huge city. And he has 2 sons. Boromir, the oldest, and Faramir. This guy, he's like his younger brother. There's about 5 years apart from each one. Boromir dies. He makes a poor decision. And he tries to save some hobbits, and he dies, alright? So, the scene I'm thinking of, the oldest is gone, alright? He died in battle. Now, the father looks at Faramir, the youngest, and says, I want you to go reclaim this city that they had just lost. It was completely overrun by all the bad guys, alright? And basically, he's asking for him to die. It's like a suicide mission. Oh, you can go back and retake the city. Yeah, right, no way. But he asks him to do it anyway. And the youngest brother, he begins to object to his father. And his father says, and I'm quoting this from the movie, is there a captain here who still has courage to do his Lord's will? And then it's like the son sees through his dad. That he realizes what's really going on. And then he says to his dad, you wish now that our places had been exchanged. That I had died. And Boromir had lived. It's like, oh, what a statement to even suggest. It's like he realizes that his father is so bitter at the hand that fate has dealt him that when he sees the youngest son, he just sees, oh, I wish I had my oldest because of that favoritism. And then his dad whispers, yes, I wish that. And you're like gutted in the scene. And then Faramir says, since you were robbed of Boromir, I will do what I can in his stead. And if I should return, which is highly unlikely, he does come back and live, but highly unlikely, going out. If I should return, think better of me, father. And then it's like the final stab. It's like twisting the knife almost. Then he says, that will depend on the manner of your return. So it's a really painful scene in the movie that's also in reference to favoritism that my mind it went to. And it hurts because in the movie, I don't know if you've seen the movie, but in the movie, you like Faramir. You're like, this is a great guy. And in the movie, he did the right thing. He denied the powerful ring, and he let the hobbits go free. And he did all these great things that made him look way better than his brother and way, way better than his father. And I know what you're thinking, that Joseph's brothers, they're wicked, they're bad. Yeah, okay, yes. Reuben, as we've already said, had done something so wicked, he had lost his birthright. Chapter 38, Judah. Whole list of sins. Had to summarize because it's rated R and he did a bunch of poor decisions. Two other brothers, probably next week, I'm going to give you more backstory out of some wicked things that they did. Different brothers of the 12, okay? So yes, these brothers are wicked, but it still doesn't excuse the fact that the father is so favoritistic and partial to Rachel's sons. And that's kind of how this chapter ends. That they're like stuck. It's like they've hit pause and no one can do anything because Jacob's not letting them leave. So they're slowly starving to death because their grain supplies are just going to get lower and lower. So they're stuck there in Canaan. And you have Simeon stuck in prison as weeks go by with no brother saving him. And you have Joseph who's waiting to see Benjamin. And they're not coming back, and they're not coming back, and they're not coming back. And then him even thinking, yeah, they have killed him. And they're not coming back because they are guilty. So everyone's stuck at this point. And it ends kind of in a bleak note. But some things to think about by way of application, and we'll be done with this message. But just some things to think about. Application. If you have a good relationship with your parents, don't undervalue it. And don't destroy it with sin. Like, take a mental note from this family. Don't make their same mistakes. Don't put yourself in a position where your parents can't trust you. Don't put yourself in a position where your parents can't trust you. Let alone can't trust you when you're in your 40s or 50s. Because that's how old these sons are. They're not really young, you know. You give them a little bit of grace because they're young, and sometimes you make foolish decisions when you're young. No, these are guys that had big families and were not taking responsibility as part of the tribe. Remember, when it comes to your parents, that when they set rules and standards, it's because they care about you and they love you and they don't want you, oftentimes, to make the same mistakes that they have made. And I know sometimes, like, I was the same way as a teen. I looked at the rules and was, really, do we have to have all these rules? Why can't I go here? Why can't I dress this way? Blah, blah, blah. Who cares about association? Guys, they're doing it because they care. Proverbs 23:24 says, the father of the righteous shall greatly rejoice. And he that begetteth a wise child. Okay, it's not talking IQ. All right, don't think, all right, he's a wise child, he's IQ 180. I don't think that way. Think in terms of wisdom, how we've learned from Proverbs to begin with in Sunday school. Wisdom is making right choices that please God. That's what wisdom is. When you have a choice, sometimes between sin, wrong, okay, maybe neutral, good, and best, wisdom is saying, I'm going to do what God would want me to do as accurately as I possibly can. And the everyday life decisions. That's what wisdom is. And he that begetteth a wise child shall have joy. Jacob wasn't having joy with his sons. All right, he wasn't. But it's not entirely his fault. But you say, perhaps, in your head, but Pastor Dan, you don't know my family, okay? And you're like, you haven't seen blah, 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 and the laundry list of their inconsistencies and their failures and all these different scenarios where they messed up. I'm sorry. I wish that wasn't the case. I really do. No parents are perfect. Okay? Trust me, do you really want to take the bitterness with you for like the rest of your life? You know what it's like to have bitterness in your 20s and 30s to your parents? Miserable. It's not fun. Yet so often, and I have talked to one recently where it was a young adult outside of the home still having bitterness towards their parents because of decisions they were, or maybe it was the picture, the perfect parent picture that was ruined because they weren't perfect, or whatever. Guys, you don't want to have that bitterness. It's like, why carry that weight around? And I'm not excusing the sin, because you can still forgive and not perfectly trust that person. Okay? It's complicated. But why carry that weight around? There are no perfect parents. And on top of that, if you ever get married and have kids, do you want your kids to respond to you the way you respond to your parents? Okay, do you want your kids to have a laundry list of all your faults and mistakes, which are many, because we're all sinners? No, we don't want that, but yet we expect our parents to be different. I would implore you, guys, to look at yourself first. It is so easy to look at others. We can get PhDs at seeing and judging others and yet have like kindergarten skills at looking at ourselves when it comes to sin. Look at yourself first. We have to be careful we don't become the group that Scripture talks about, that says great things, that talks big, and yet doesn't really follow God. Titus 1:16. They profess that they know God, that they have this relationship with Him, but in their works, they deny Him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate. Does anyone know what reprobate means? It has the idea that whatever it is comes up false. That maybe you're thinking in a warehouse and you're building things and you're like, oh, there's a crack in that. I just think of the sound effect when I hear the word. Failure doesn't work. Oftentimes in ancient times it was used as an example in coins. Like you would bite a coin, see if it was genuine. You'd be like, oh! Or you'd scrape it. That's not a gold coin. That's a lead coin with gold plating. And that's someone trying to counterfeit. Okay, that's what reprobate means. When you really show it up in the limelight, it's false. It's wrong. And we can be that with our lives. We can look great, and then we go under the surface, half a millimeter, and we're wicked and sinful, and we have all these horrible motives, and we're not good people. Okay, that's typically how it is. So look at yourself first. Is there a hidden sin in your life? Is there something that you have to have? A lust. You can't have. If you can't have it, you're just miserable and sad, and life doesn't have any meaning, and you've overvalued one thing. Not necessarily wrong. It could be totally 100% wrong, but it could possibly be something neutral that we've valued above God. Do you have something like that in your life? And is that the reason that perhaps joy is being sucked out of your life? Are you more joyful now than you were when you had a right relationship with your parents and a right relationship with God? It's a tough question. Think about these things. These family situations we see in the story of Joseph really happened. And if you're honest with yourself, you look at it and you're like, yeah, that's pretty common. That happens all the time. I will be giving a situation and a story from a counseling book that looks impossible to solve. Because in reality, guys, our sin is impossible in and of ourselves to solve it. But I'm going to give you a counseling scenario where you're like, wow, this is messed up. It's wrong here, 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 here. And just when you thought things were going to get better, all this extra sin. And then I'm going to show you a real life example of this real story. The names have been changed, but it's a real story of how the Scripture and the Bible and God helped this couple. All right? I actually have plenty of these stories in the counseling books I took at college. But we're going to go through that because I want you to... this story to connect with you, saying that this is real, guys. But that's what I have for you today. Think about it. Look at yourself first. Don't make the same mistakes as these brothers did. Thanks for listening.